Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, thanks for coming back to Soul Sisters. I'm your host, Jessie Katz, and I have a very exciting episode to share with you today. I am being very emphatic about how exciting this episode is because it is with one of my favorite artists of all time who has recorded one of my favorite songs of all time. That song is called Stay, I Missed You. It is also from one of my favorite movies of all time. That movie is called Reality Bites. And the guest I'm talking about is Lisa Loeb. Lisa Loeb is on Soul Sisters today. It's a really big deal. I hope you guys understand. This is a big deal to me. It's a big deal to Dara. It's a big deal to Billboard. And hopefully it's a big deal to you. And that's why you clicked on this episode of Soul Sisters. We spent about an hour talking with Lisa. I'm going to give you the full conversation. She's so smart, so interesting. Walked through every minute of how Stay was written and recorded and passed along to Ethan Hawke and made it into the hands of Ben Stiller and got into the movie and made Lisa Loeb the first artist to have a number one song before being signed to a label, which is crazy if you think about it. And we had a lot of questions for her about how it all went down. I mean, we went way back into her career before that, and we also zoomed way forward to find out what she's been doing now. She has some awesome children's albums out, and she is about to do a stint at the Cafe Carlisle in New York, June 6th to the 17th. If you're in the city, you definitely want to check her out. And here's the other thing, guys. She actually performed a live set in the Billboard office when she was here. And at the end of this episode, we included her playing Stay live in the office. So you want to sit back, relax, savor this one, and enjoy it till the end. I promise it won't disappoint. Without further ado, Lisa Loeb on Soul Sisters.
What do you do as an artist? How do you take part in the revolution?
Yeah, is that, it's going to be okay. It's going to be all right.
It's going to be all right is more for children.
But applicable to other situations.
Right. No, I think, through music in general, it's hard because I've never been like a... I always thought it was really hard to write about specific topics, like political topics. Mm-hmm. But I feel like definitely through my kids' music, it's given me a place to write about positive things. I mean, I always did that in my grown-up music, try to take a look at something to see what is in your control, because mm-hmm. you can't control other people, mm-hmm. but figure out what is in your control. And on my most recent record, I have a song about respecting each other, like you say hello, you know, even just give them a head nod.
Yeah.
I just had an inside burp, sorry. So you give people at least a head nod. You know, you respect people enough to say hello. You try to remember, you know, there's a lot of negativity going around. Try to remind kids and grown-ups that you can, you know, take a U-turn or try anything is in your... power to try at least. Mm-hmm. You know, you might not succeed all the time, but you can try. It's normal to be nervous or worried, but, you know, you try for something more positive. But I don't know. I think I started writing songs like that too because I was often asked to play at a huge gay parade or like a, you know, gay pride or, you know, these wonderful benefits for these amazing, positive organizations and people trying to do good in the world. And uh-huh. I'd get up and they're like, play Stay, I Missed You. And I'm happy to play it, but it's not a happy song. And it's right. not like a very encouraging song. So I got together with a friend.
It makes people happy.
It makes people happy, but it never feels quite appropriate.
Right. Yeah.
So, and I have a couple of upbeat songs, but they still don't really fit any of those. Mm-hmm. those events. And so I actually, when I got together with a guy I met, it was very weird. I was taking a writing class, writing like writing, not
horse songwriting, riding.
Not horse riding, definitely. I'm allergic to horses and hay. I sing about that on my new record, but I'm allergic to horses. But I was doing a writing class just because I felt like I needed to do more writing, and I was kind of getting stuck here and there. And
when was this?
Song
just writing, and yeah, just song. I think I wanted to be a better writer.
But are we talking about mid-career you did this?
Yeah, or? Like about 5 years ago or something.
Oh, wow.
And my friend was taking this writing class. She's working on a book. And I thought, well, that'd be great structure to have to sit down and write. This is a very long story. I can go backwards in time to give you even more information.
We will. We'll take you back. But this is
so
good.
About this one particular song, though, first, I was taking this writing class. And the very final, there were many classes. My actual class, I couldn't be at the actual final where you get up and read something you wrote. It's for people of all different levels. It's not different leveled writing. Different people are all mixed together and different levels of experience.
You're actually physically
going to a class. I'm going to a class. It's not
like you have... Can you imagine being in a writing class with
But it's not like homework or anything. It's just like this ongoing class that you can go to. And you write and he gives you... there's different exercises to write.
Right.
And then you write them and you get up and you read them. And that's part of it. And people critique it or whatever.
Yeah.
Or they don't critique it. Maybe they don't critique it. Maybe they just hear it.
Okay.
And they respond to it that they heard it.
That's so vulnerable.
Maybe there's some critiquing. It is. And it's writing.
Yeah.
And it's more about expressing yourself and I don't know. People take it for all different reasons.
Right.
For me, it was structure. And I always have so many things going on. I was like, I need to just do more writing. This will be good structure. But the very final class, I wasn't able to go to my own class. So I was going to another class's final where you get up and you read. Final meaning the last class, not like tests.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. and also the teacher over the last month or so realized I was a singer. He didn't know I was a singer and he loves music. And so he said, oh, would you get up and sing a song in front of the class as well?
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. And this woman afterwards came up to me and introduced herself. She was a creative psychologist or somebody who helps people, you know, find their creative path. I don't remember the exact name of the job that she did.
She's like a creative coach.
But she said, oh, you know, my son is a songwriter too. Let me get you a CD. I was like, oh, okay. You know, a lot of people give me CDs and there are a handful that are good, but you know, there's a lot of CDs that start to stack up on my desk.
Yeah.
Sorry. And I'm kicking feet here. And so she gave me this CD and her son's, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to listen to this. I'm not going to procrastinate it. I'm just going to listen to it. It's not going to sit on my desk.
That's so nice of you to listen to it.
So I got in my car. I had to drive over the hill back to my house.
Uh-huh.
And I put the CD in. And it was one of the most beautiful CDs I'd ever heard.
No way.
And it was in my car for years. It ended up being in my car for years and years and years. It's probably still one of the five CDs in my car. Yes, I still listen to CDs in my car. they're better quality. But it was beautiful. And the guy's name was Eric Lumiere. And I got in touch with him and I asked if he would write with me. And it was sort of the beginning of me thinking, you know, I need to collaborate more again. Because I like writing by myself. I valued writing by myself over everything.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, I'd had some taste of collaboration. And it was actually really fun and easy, but it didn't exactly feel right. And so I sort of would reject it. It wasn't exactly me writing my own songs.
Yeah.
But I got to a point where I was like, I just need to write, you know? It's okay. I listen to so much music that's... people have collaborated on. I can come back to writing by myself more.
Right.
It's okay. Like, just don't be so hard on yourself. Just do this. So I called him and we finally got together. And when Eric and I sat down to write, I was just about to go play a big gay pride parade in Nashville. And I said, you know, I'd really like to write some songs like, I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of songs you get up and everyone's so happy to hear because it brings everyone together and they're all singing. It's not like about a breakup and sitting on a bed or something. You know,
it becomes a happy anthem.
It's a happy anthem. It's anthemic. It's something people can sing together. So we wrote a song called Sing Out. And we still have to put it on a record, but it's... the chorus is, it's my parade, so make it great. Blow your horn, throw confetti, celebrate. You can march, you can dance. Every moment is your chance to be yourself and sing out. And then has a whole la 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 section that anyone in any country can sing. But it was very, it's positive.
Awesome.
And you can sing it. And I can get up and sing that in the middle of so many different events now. And it's very practical, but it feels good too.
Yeah.
Right? To be able to sing something that's positive, not just a popular song about how angry I am or,
yeah.
thinly cut. But
your music has that feel always. I mean, and even when it might have a darker tone or theme, there is a buoyancy to most of it that I feel like. So, you know, that fits in nicely.
Yeah, I've been focusing kind of on that for, I think, because since when I started getting songs on the radio and had a bigger professional career, mm-hmm. I did get invited to do more benefits and songs and political benefits and all kinds of stuff. And it just feels better when you have something that's appropriate as at least one of the three songs that you're going to sing.
Yeah.
And so.
Are you playing at any prides this year?
I'm not, but I have been singing that, not yet, but okay. I have been singing that song at all kinds of shows, and uh-huh. I often end song sets with it, both at kids' shows and grown-up shows, and people, even if they haven't heard it before, they kind of, like, walk slowly towards the stage, yeah. you know, with their
That's a good sign.
Proverbial candles, you know, just sort of, like,
yeah.
singing together at an end of a Peanuts uh-huh. gang yeah. Christmas special or something. but it, awesome. It brings people together, and, you know, when you play live a lot, I start feeling a difference with both of my kids' music and grown-up music. There are certain songs that are great live songs, mm-hmm. certain songs that are fun to listen to on the recordings. There's just different kinds of songs you need. And as a live performer, you're there. You know, you want things to feel like they're connecting and working in that mm-hmm. moment. And sometimes it's nice to have broad, big songs. And sometimes it usually is a good idea to have those.
Yeah. You know. Was there someone in your life who did for you what you've done for Eric Lumiere? Like, did you have a moment like that? Did you, like, ever try to, like, reach somebody
well,
who actually listened to you?
He had some success. He had,
before
he has,
you.
Yeah, he had, he writes these beautiful melodic songs, and he had had some success in Europe with uh-huh. People doing dance remix. Like, he's got really big hits now, and he's worked with a lot of great people. But he was, I think, surprised that I called him out of the blue.
Right. Like, did you ever take a chance when you were struggling? To, like,
oh, I took every chance. I've taken every chance as a musician. In fact, sometimes I look back and I'm like, I was listening to Suzanne Vega's interview that mm-hmm. she did with you guys, and I was thinking, it's so funny because when I was in high school, I was already writing music and making recordings on cassette tapes for friends. They wanted recordings of my songs. Uh-huh. And it really, really started happening after I did this summer acting program with a lot of folks from the East Coast. I'm from Texas. Mm-hmm. And there were all these East Coast people and New York people. And they would come to my dorm room in London and they'd say, oh, you know, play us some of your songs. Oh, you should record that. And I'd make little tape recorder recordings of them. And at one point, my friend Jenny Weiner, who lives here in New York, she said, she told me after the fact, like after London, she's like, you really need to listen to this woman. You sound a lot like her, and she sounds a lot like you. And she told me to listen to Suzanne Vega. And I went and got her album, and I said, oh, my gosh. Especially in my earlier days, I was even more hushed and probably more spoken and hushed. And not that Suzanne Vega is always hushed and spoken, but there is a quality that's mm-hmm. spoken. Yeah. It sounds like her voice, you know,
yeah.
it's her speaking voice. And I was like, oh my God, it kind of does. This is really weird, you know?
Is that encouraging or discouraging?
It was encouraging. Okay. I mean, I felt so unique, but then I heard her and I was like, I guess I'm not 100% unique.
But can be successful.
It's so there, and that's so cool, you know? And so later when I was in college and I had a singing group with my friend Elizabeth Mitchell, we had a group called Liz and Lisa, and we were like, mm-hmm. popular on campus, and you know, people would write us fan notes, and we'd make records. I think Suzanne Vega came to play in Providence, where I went to Brown, and Suzanne Vega, I think she was playing in Providence, maybe she was playing at Brown, I don't remember. Uh-huh. But I made a mixtape for her of like all these songs we had recorded and our own original songs, and you know, probably one of her songs. I think we used to do, I don't know which song of hers we used to do. But I gave her, you know, our songs.
Your version of her song.
Her song. And, you know, and in retrospect, you just don't do that to a musician. But we thought that's what you're supposed to do. You really give, one of the best demo tapes someone ever gave me uh-huh. was three or four songs. And it was just one song that faded into the next. Like you could listen to all five songs in about 2 minutes or less.
That's smart.
But it really gave me a taste of what they sounded like.
Right.
And it's, as a musician, especially when I was in college, that would have been horrifying. Like, of course you would listen to the whole songs and really take it all
so
in.
You're so precious, yeah.
Yeah, everything is so important, but...
Well, I heard you became so attuned to what would work that, like, you were very aware of even how much space to leave on a mixtape so that when you would... Or on a demo tape so when you'd flip it over...
Yeah, well, that...
It would,
yeah.
You know, like...
Well, no, everybody knew back in the day that when you made a cassette tape, which is what we all made back in the 80s, and even early 90s, you would make the first side longer so that when you flipped it over, the music would start at the beginning. Whereas if the first side was too short, when you flipped it over, you'd have to rewind to get to the beginning of the second side.
So that was just something everyone knew, but you were using it as a tool.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so hustling cassette tapes was...
Was
what you would do. And so so now do you feel like it's a pay it forward situation where if someone does give you a demo?
Oh, yeah. I feel like it's very important. Well, A, I might miss something if I don't listen to people's records. B, I was that person. I think of myself when I was younger all the time, you know, because I did get a lot of big breaks what felt like big breaks at the time for opening for other acts. In Dallas, when I went home from college, I got to open for Edie Brickell. Oh, wow. They were called the New Bohemians at the time, but it was Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians. Uh-huh. I don't know if she booked that show, but it was a big deal because they were a popular band in Texas before they became a national band.
Uh-huh. Was this after this Brown was before, or before?
This was during Brown. Okay. Yeah, this was during Brown. I was thinking if it was in high school. I knew Edie Brickell in high school. I don't think I opened for a band in high school, though.
How did you know Edie Brickell in high school?
Edie Brickell's art teacher and advisor at school was my best friend's mom.
Oh, wow.
So Edie worked at, like, the cool movie theater. She worked at the record store. And we knew her. She was, like, a cool student of my friend's mom.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I think it means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. You know, so I try to listen to other people's music because to me it meant a lot. I opened for the band The Samples, which is sort of a jam band from Colorado. I had opportunities. We got to open for Mary Chapin Carpenter at Brown when she came and played in this huge arena. Mm-hmm. And so, I think it's amazing, you know, for people to have the guts to give someone a CD or tape. I do my best to listen to whatever I can.
Right.
But I can't listen to everything. It's hard because I just don't have time.
Of course. And I apologize if you're tired of telling the story, but we are at Billboard and you do have the distinction of being the first unsigned artist to ever have a number one on the Hot 100 chart. Let's say.
So cool.
And I feel like that also happened in a very organic way for you, right? That you got on that soundtrack?
Yeah, it was very, it's funny because when it happened, it seemed all very normal and natural. In retrospect, I realize it was really unusual because things that you think are going to happen almost never happen.
Right.
I mean, it's great that you know, I live in Los Angeles now where I think one of the reasons Los Angeles is so great is you always think there's like a rainbow. For some reason, even, you know, you're constantly getting slammed down and just people tell you no all the time. And you hear that when you go to career counseling festivals, like, beware, everyone's going to tell you no. But they do. Everybody says no. There's just a gajillion no's. It's
versus
all no's.
New York. I mean, New York is the
it's
same.
All
but
no's.
It's,
everybody tells you no all the time. No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
No, you're never going to, this is never going to happen. It's unusual. It will never happen. And with this, with the song Stay, I graduated from Brown. I was already, felt like I was having a successful music career. Mm-hmm. My friend Liz and I went straight from playing, even while we were at Brown, we had record company interest. There was somebody who was interested from EMI Records.
Did that come from a show that they saw you at, or was it giving out demos as well?
It was everything. We played at, like, new music seminars, and I don't know if we were doing that in college, but we were playing concerts.
It was the hustle. You were hustling.
Yeah, we were making records. Yeah. We were making cassette tapes, and we were playing concerts in L.A., Providence, Boston, New York. We'd come to New York and play at the Bitter End. Mm-hmm. We had friends who had friends, and one of our friends knew somebody was sort of starting to kind of help us out in a management capacity, you know, helping connect us with people. And one of the people she knew someone else, and they worked at EMI Records. And this guy, Rob Gordon, and Rob was a great source of information about the record industry and the music business and how it all worked. Mm-hmm. And he's very independent. He actually has his own music record company called War, What Are Records, in Colorado still. And he's very independent, and he looked at things in a very independent way. But I also thought of getting a record deal as being like, that was getting a job out of college. Like, you get a record deal. Anyway, in college, Rob was interested. He was going to have his boss come see us, or he did have his boss come see us. His boss was Ron Fair, who ran at EMI Records. And Rob either got fired the day that his boss was supposed to come see us, or his boss came see us and he didn't want to sign us or whatever, mm-hmm. my friend Liz and I. But anyway, there was interest. It made us feel like, wow, this is actually happening.
Yeah.
We're actually playing the Bitter End, like major places, uh-huh. and having full houses of people because we had such a great support system from Brown and their friends, and the word had gotten out and people came to listen to us. So it was, things always seemed like they were moving forward. And then Liz and I went our own separate ways as far as our bands. She and her husband, Dan, started the band Ida, mm-hmm. which is a really popular indie band. And now Liz also does a lot of kids' music, lots of beautiful records.
And was that an amicable, just like a mutual separation?
It was a mutual separation, yeah. I think we just had different ideas about where we wanted to go. And she was, you know, in a relationship with her husband, and they were making this beautiful music, and they were kind of going more of an indie route. Mm-hmm. And I think I was just more, you know, commercial.
You're like, I want that record deal.
I was like, I need a record deal. Right. I need to get a job, you know. And I think Liz was kind of like, you know, she's just more like organic and natural and real. And I'm more like, let me put on my eyelashes. We're going on stage. You know, I'm from Dallas.
And that's how you were out of the gate, out of college.
Yeah, and I was like that in college as well. I don't know. It's just, but we made beautiful music together. But I think we just had sort of a different idea of what directions we were going, mm-hmm. and it was time to go our ways. But anyway, moving to New York, we are friends with Josh Hamilton, who's an actor, mm-hmm. who went to Brown, and Josh had just been in a movie with Ethan. He did the movie Alive, which is all these guys who are on a soccer team and they die in a plane or they crash.
Alive was the most terrifying movie of my childhood.
Yeah, me too.
Like,
it scares
me so
badly.
You weren't allowed to watch it, but you would kind of watch it when it was on TV, but then you get too afraid and you turn it off.
It's
and then you just like thought about it all the time.
Yeah, it's a plane and they're going
it's
to Colombia.
Okay.
Yeah, somebody
eat each other in the snow.
It's terrifying. Terrible. They crash and.
That was based on a real story.
It was based on a real story. Yeah. And every time I'm on a plane with like a sports team, I'm like, we're gonna crash. This is terrible.
Yeah, it's like Jaws for
every
flying
plane,
over
yeah.
snowy terrain.
Every the plane I get teams, on, I think I'm gonna crash. It's not a good. It's not a good thought for somebody who travels a lot.
Yeah,
it's terrible. So anyway, Ethan had just been in this movie Alive, and he just was friends with all these actor boys because it was all these boys and Ileana Douglas, and then he had also been
a few
years earlier had been in Dead Poets Society, which again with a ton of boys,
right?
And I was a huge fan of that movie, but so I met Ethan, and that was really cool because I was a big fan of his. I loved Dead Poets so much when I saw it. I went to visit my brother at Harvard. We went to go see the movie in the square, and it was so good. We went back the next night and saw it again. You know, it was just amazing.
Yeah. And where
depressing.
Were you living at the time?
In New York?
Yeah.
I was living downtown. I just moved from Bowery and Bond, which was near Seabees. It was not the best area at the time in the East Village. Actually, it was funny. When I moved to New York, I lived with Liz's family on the Upper East Side in this crazy townhouse. Like, we all had our own bathrooms, and it was marble and elevators. And, you know, the people who moved into the apartment after us was Mariah Carey.
Oh, wow.
It was crazy. But after that, I moved to Bowery and Bond, which was down in the East Village. And it was like the public restroom for the neighborhood.
Right.
the door was. But then after that, I went back to school. My parents said they would help support me a little bit if I went back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what? That's a good idea because I've been working in, you know, room service at a boutique hotel. It's only been like 2 years after college,
right.
And I'm like getting desperate.
And you studied literature. You did not
study literature.
Music.
I didn't study music, although I did tons of music classes.
Obviously.
And I took recording classes where we recorded our own music and we critiqued each other's music. It's kind of like the best of all worlds because we had great supportive audience, fan base of friends and fans and Brown, you know, our college students who would just pack the house every time we would play.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in music classes with all these other musicians who are now, a lot of them professional musicians who, you know, score the movies we watch, like mm-hmm. Marco Beltrami and Duncan Sheik. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, these were all our classmates and it was a very high standard of
like musicianship.
Songwriting and musicianships. and we would critique each other's music in these classes. But anyway, after college, I hadn't gotten a record deal. And I was, you know, working at Hold Everything, which is a Pottery Barn-owned store, an organization store. And, you know, just doing different day jobs and temping. I did a lot of temp work, which is great. Because often when you're a temp worker and you can type pretty fast, you get really good temp work for high-level executives who are on vacation and their secretaries are on vacation. There is whatever, administrative assistants are on vacation. So you're sitting in a gorgeous office overlooking Central Park, sort of randomly doing mail I don't even know what.
And thinking of lyrics.
And making flyers on the Xerox copy machines and like being awake way earlier than a musician should ever be awake wearing an Ann Taylor suit. But
drinking that free coffee.
Yeah.
Seriously, drinking coffee and using losing free, their supplies, like, white paper.
Right.
They gave me office supplies. They gave me office supplies.
Because that's the work of it. That was the promotion. That was, you know, you could make phone calls and
It was great.
You're not sending emails. You're you're just.
And usually, if you were hired at that job, your boss was out of town.
Right.
So I did do one job, actually. The last temp job I had was at Ernst & Young. And I did it, I feel like, for a few months. I don't know if my sense of time is exactly right, but it felt like I was there. I was at Scholastic for a while, which was so cool. I got all these kids' books, and it was just so cool. It was before computers, so I would hand-deliver things. Uh-huh. And, you know, they weren't using computers a lot for mass emails. And I got to help order the office supplies. And it was just really colorful and wonderful, and I love Scholastic books. And then after that, Ernst & Young, which was like office. Yeah. And they... I was working in the real estate department making reports. I don't even know what I was doing. They had me doing things that I wasn't qualified to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I met Ethan Hawke through another actor, and it was awesome. It was a couple years after, you know, it was like right after college. Mm-hmm. It was a great community. It was Ethan, and Ethan had friends like John Mark Sherman, who's a playwright, and, you know, there were actors and musicians. Our friend Jesse Harris and Rebecca Martin, they had a group called Blue. Jesse ended up writing a lot of those huge hits for Norah Jones. Mm-hmm. And
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My friend Juan Patino started producing my records. And
where were you in the band life? Were you a solo artist or were you with Nine Stories?
Well, I became a solo artist. Okay. I was a solo artist, but Nine Stories was a band name Liz Mitchell and I came up with when we played with our band. Because as a musician early on, when you used your own names, like even Liz and Lisa, it sounded like an acoustic folk duo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were an acoustic duo, but we weren't a folk duo. We were just playing songs, like if Elvis Costello took his band away or something. You know, there was a lot of variety, and we were like singer-songwriters. We weren't folk, you know?
Yeah.
There were a lot of harmonies, but there was a lot of stigma attached to that we didn't feel connected to.
Right.
Like her favorite musician was Bruce Springsteen and Joni Mitchell, and I liked Led Zeppelin, and we liked Prince, and I liked Elvis Costello, and
It's hard
the Police and David Bowie. So why weren't they folk with an acoustic guitar?
Right,
right.
Yeah,
it's hard without the groove. If you have two acoustic guitars and voices.
Yeah.
For people to sort of understand the vibe,
and just,
I guess.
You see two girls on a guitar and you're like, oh, you're folk.
Yeah. Right.
It's like,
I'm going to keep us on task with this story, though.
Oh, yeah. So
I'm buttoning you up over there.
Yeah,
in the
corner. Nine Stories was the name of the band we came up with, which is a J.D. Salinger idea.
Yeah.
And it just, which is a whole other story. But anyway, I kept the band Nine Stories, the name band Nine Stories. And again, I would try to sort of promote myself as Nine Stories or Lisa Loeb in Nine Stories. Mm. So people would have the idea that it's a band sound, that there's going to be a lot of variety in the sound that you're going to hear. It's not going to be super folky.
Right.
So
you're palling around the East Village.
Yeah, we're all palling around the West Village. Actually, I was living right near NYU.
Okay.
Oh, so I had gone back to school at NYU studying psychology.
Oh, wow.
Because I was like, my parents are right. You know, if I don't become a professional musician, it would be much more fun to be like a psychologist or study the brain or... You know,
so this was grad school?
Yeah, it was grad school.
So was that a hard, sad kind of feeling to say, this might not work out?
No, I think because I secretly felt like, you know, this is already no, that's a good question. I secretly felt like this is already happening. So on one hand, I was sort of pacifying my parents, but I was actually pacifying myself as well because I didn't want to be selling padded hangers and Lucite boxes and waking up at ungodly hours. Because even when I did temp work, I get so I'm so involved in being part of the team and doing a good job. You know, I'm kind of like very I'm a type B, but with a very hard type A lining. Like, I get very involved. You know, I'm not like my Harvard friends who are very type A. I'm like a Brown student. But I'm very involved. And I was like, if I'm going to put my heart into this, you know, as a musician, I do have time to be in school or having another job. You know, and I tell musicians that today, don't quit every job. You know, like, jobs are important. They help, or school or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You have to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And you have to have a full life. And being a musician is really hard. You know, being a musician back in the early 90s, we were doing what everybody did, making flyers, calling your friends to come to shows, hand writing out postcards to hundreds of people to send to and hand post. You had to put the stamp on by hand. They didn't even have machines you could use or, you know, print it on your computer. It was just very tedious writing your songs, recording, figuring out where you're going to record, you know, making cassette tapes and selling them. It was, you know, pounding the pavement.
Media, which I wonder,
social media.
That makes it harder, but in a way, I wonder if it also makes it easier because it's like only the select few that are really hustling are gonna be noticed, whereas yeah. you can be a little bit lazier right. with social media.
You had to like put more out, you had people. To make a tape and then physically hand it to people.
Yeah, hand it to people, which you is, can just you throw know, it and, online. Like have a package and write the address on it. Mm-hmm. And now I was lucky, again, my friend Rob Gordon, for example, said, you need to find an assistant. You need to find somebody who can help you mm-hmm. with some of these tasks because you need to continue writing your music and recording your music and I love the music business. I mean, I don't love the music business, but I like the business of music and marketing. And I have that part of me that I love thinking of new ideas and how are we going to get the music out there? And,
yeah.
you know, as well as the complete other side of me, which is I'm writing songs. You know, like.
Right, they're very just, different.
They're different places, but I'm inspired by both of them. So I found my friend Amy, who is running Ethan Hawke's theater company. She helped me with a lot of these things. Like, she started helping me with the flyers and the, you know, some of the administrative tasks and which was super helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd like put up posters and yeah. things like
that. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah. So, anyway, I was going to NYU taking a couple of classes midway through, a year in or so. Halfway through a year, I realized, you know what? If I'm going to school, this is so interesting and awesome. I should have studied psychology in college instead of literature, comp lit, you know, Ulysses and Faulkner and all those things that are just Joyce. That's just not helpful in life. Yes, I can analyze
text. Teaches you how to think.
I know, that's but I was already thinking in high school. We learned how to analyze texts in high school, like in Spanish class. It was yeah, amazing. Right. But, you know... So I was going to NYU, and I loved it. And I thought, wow, this would be a really cool job at some point. But music is taking too much time. I can't do this and go to school. So I did live near NYU in one of those high rises. I kept going from, like, beautiful apartment to kind of weird, random, like the loft I was living in with five other guys in the Bowery. And then beautiful high rise cookie cutter apartment near NYU, which was across the street from Ethan Hawke, who was living on Waverly Place in one of those cool... You know, more walk-up apartments with those black iron painted windows, old-timey.
Yeah.
But, you know, you literally, we'd shout up the window to each other like, hey, you know, want to go get brunch? What are you doing? And we'd go get brunch down the street, you know. And
did that make you feel like I'm in some sort of circle that's leading me somewhere?
It really was. I felt like I was, it was because we were all, it was funny because it was this quote-unquote slacker generation, right. Generation X.
Right.
And here was Ethan about to make this movie about Generation X. And yet these were the most hardworking people I knew, you know, Robert Sean Leonard, Ethan Hawke, John Sherman, Pete Dinklage was one of our gang, you know.
Oh, really?
I'm sure I'm leaving, and Gordon Greenberg, who makes musicals, and, you know, all these very successful. Callista Flockhart was in the theater company. And
what were some of the big credits to your career at that point as a musician?
I got to play for Z100 down at the World Trade Center. Which was big, like doing something for a big radio station, playing at the New Music Festival, playing at South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. Record companies were interested. I had demo deals with record companies.
Yeah. So you where felt the momentum.
Paying me to do things. I played at CBGB's. I was playing at what is that place called that we all played? Like Blues Traveler and Joan Osborne. And we all played at it was more of the groovy jam band place. Oh my God, my brain.
Is it still around?
No, but we were all playing there. You know, we were all in great circles, and Jeff Buckley, and people were getting deals, and, you know, the A&R people were interested in bringing their people, and it was just sort of all happening. The crowds were there. There were lots of people showing up and people buying tapes and CDs, and people from other cities were writing notes to me. And it just felt like, you know, this is really happening.
Yeah.
And even in college, Liz and I made a demo with one of Suzanne Vega's guitar players, and her bass player played on our demo. And it sounded like it was real, and people were really showing up. So yes, it felt sad, like, well, this might not happen, but it didn't feel like that.
Right.
It felt more like, well, sure, I'll go back to college. It's like a bonus. Right. Like, I'll go back to grad school. I get to learn things.
Yeah. Did money follow with these types of gigs?
Yeah, like the CB's Gallery paid really well. I think they paid you the door, which is a big deal at the time. I played at this place called Cottonwood Cafe where they'd pay you $75, which was a lot, and they'd feed you. And all your friends could come for free. They didn't have to buy anything, which was big. And then, you know, Tatum O'Neill would come see me play. And there were interesting people in the audience and people who knew people, and it just felt like, you know, things were happening.
Yeah.
And this was only a couple years out of college. So it just felt like, I think this is happening. I'm sure in the back of my head, I was always like, I had the voice of my parents, like, if this isn't going anywhere, you need to move on. But things kept happening.
Yeah. Had you made the purple tape by this point when you were living across from Ethan?
I made the purple tape, I think, in 1991, like a year after college.
Right.
Because I'd been singing with Liz for so many years that I thought, you know, I need, and it's funny, I heard Joan Osborne, I've been listening to your show, Joan Osborne saying, yeah, we all made cassette tapes because people wanted to buy your music, you know? And it was important to have a calling card, to have music that sounded like you, that you could share. And although I saw myself as being more of a part of a band, for myself, I needed to hear myself singing my songs. Liz had sung a lot of my songs, and I still was singing some of the songs that, a lot of the songs that we did together that I had written. I needed to get used to myself being the lead singer instead of more of the harmony singer. I needed to get more and more confident with that emotionally. I think on stage, physically, I seemed confident, but I emotionally needed to get used to that.
Right.
You know, I felt like Simon and Garfunkel, we've broken up, and I'm like by myself now.
Wow.
But, you know, I needed to get used to that and feel confident with that and have something to sell. So I made that in around 1991. And
so you were ready for people to swoop you up.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did Stay end up on Reality Bites?
So
just
I was
to come back to this Billboard.
So I was playing concerts and, you know, all of our friends, everybody would come to see me play. We'd go see our other friends play. And, and I was doing music for Ethan's theater company. I wrote music for some of his plays. And Ethan asked for a copy of the song Stay. Stay was one of the songs that I played live as well as like a bunch of other songs. And that was a song that people just would request a lot. I remember, again, Tatum O'Neill said, oh, will you play the song Stay? You know, like.
So it was already like a locally famous song.
It was kind of like a little bit of a song, as well as a couple of other songs that were kind of popular.
Yeah.
And
who did you say you wrote that for?
I wrote that, well, at the time, my friend Jeff Cohen, who is working at BMI, which is a music, they collect music for you when, I mean, they collect money for you when your songs are played on the radio.
Okay.
And that was a place where you didn't have to get signed, like somebody sign you, you just sort of signed up for it.
Mm-hmm.
You would sign up for BMI or ASCAP or CSAC, mostly BMI or ASCAP. And it was a great way to be a part of the music industry. They had events, the singer-songwriter circles in the round, at the Bitter End. I played at the Bitter End a lot. And you were part of like a professional community. And again, that was another thing that made me feel like things are happening.
Yeah.
But Jeff told me, BMI also might tell you that like certain acts are looking for songs for their records.
Okay.
And I had never written songs for other people, but I heard Daryl Hall was looking for music. And I thought, oh my gosh.
Was he solo then?
I think he was doing a solo record.
Okay.
And I loved all the classic, you know, they call it Blue-Eyed Soul. You know, these white guys from Philly singing this R&B.
And Dara's laughing because our first guest on the show is Susan Tedeschi.
Oh, Susan.
Yeah,
I heard Susan.
Yeah.
And she was talking about that. I know. It's true, though, but but I love Daryl Hall and John Oates. And I loved, you know, Sarah Smile and Rich Girl, all the things that have these blues, or not blues, they're more like R&B grooves with these beautiful melodies.
Mm-hmm.
So I started writing something with a little groove, chords that went back and forth. And I thought, oh, I'll get this to Daryl Hall. Of course, that opportunity didn't happen, like most things don't. So I just continued writing the song. And at the time, I was at Berklee Music School going to summer school.
Okay. I saw that you went there. I went there the summer after.
Oh,
I
you
went
did?
To college.
You went, did you go to college there?
I went to college at BU, at Boston University. And then
the windiest school around.
And then I stayed the summer after I graduated to go to the Berklee summer session. Changed my life. It was like the most joyful experience.
For me, it was a little scary because my brother had been there when he was a teenager, when you're supposed to go to Berklee summer school.
Yeah.
I was like, I was like 3 years out of college, I think. And I was, again, I'm always looking for these schooled opportunities to become more organized and to do more of the thing that I want to do. And for me, Berklee Music School was, I think I've said this before, but it was like the, being the eighth grade boy that I never was, who sits in their room and like plays guitar for hours and hours and hours. I was playing guitar a lot when I was in eighth grade, but I was doing all these other things. I didn't like sit and shut myself up in my room. I wrote songs and I played guitar, but I didn't. At Berklee, you could sit in a practice room. You kind of had to. But I was like the grown up with all these teenage kids, yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. I wasn't living in the dorms, but I was kind of like, yeah, grown up.
Right. But being in an institution surrounded by music.
Oh, it was great. Like, yeah. It was challenging. Yeah. You know? But it was really cool too, because they would figure out what level you were in all these different areas of music, so you could go in and be challenged at your level on ear training or reading or soloing or whatever. So I was finishing writing the song Stay then, and I was busking in Harvard Square, you actually sign up ahead of time and they put you on a calendar and you're playing in front of Abompan. Wow. And it's, you know, and I had done that before during college when I went to Harvard Summer School.
That's funny. Bougie busking.
Yeah, you had to reserve a spot. But
well, I guess that's like the subway in New York now.
It is. Now you have to reserve a spot. It's like professional.
It's under New York. Venue. It's a real program.
So, yeah, I had been to Berklee and that's where I finished writing the song, and I was actually living off campus with two other Berklee students, and one of them was this amazing R&B singer, and she sang like Whitney Houston. It was unbelievable, and I thought, gosh, I should really get her to sing this song, and I asked her to, and she said no.
Whoa.
I was like, all right, okay. You know, I was just like, it'd be so amazing for her to record it.
Wow.
So I wrote the song then, and then I had recorded a couple versions of the song as part of my demo deals. One was more of kind of a harder rock version. Mm-hmm. I recorded with Kevin Salem. And then the other one I recorded with Juan Patino, who I'd made the acoustic tape with. And our version was the final version. And we recorded it in his apartment on 52nd Street. You know, literally a two-bedroom apartment that we had sort of functioned into a studio. And, you know, we loved Steely Dan and Clean Sounds and all these different things. And we recorded it with my band, Nine Stories. And that's the tape. And so Amy Armstrong, my friend, says, who is helping me with the administrative work and stuff and working with Ethan, she said she remembers giving Ethan the tape. I remember the tape having a couple of my songs and songs by other friends, too. I don't know. And Ethan says that it was just my songs. I don't know. And I had already tried to write songs for Ethan for the movie, too.
Uh-huh.
He asked me to take a shot at writing a song called I'm Nothing for the band he plays in the movie Reality Bites. And so did Gordon Gano from Violent Femmes, and so did Soul Asylum. Crazy. Soul Asylum's version got into the movie.
Oh, that's funny.
Mine wasn't even really that great of a song. But so he still asked for music. And Ben Stiller, all the powers, there was a lot of powers mm-hmm. that be that yeah. put the song into the movie.
Okay.
But Ethan asked for it. But like the people who put it in the movie, the producer Stacey Scher and Ben Stiller, who was directing it, they were supposed to go see U2 play in Ireland and show them the film, but the plane was U2 had to cancel that, so they stayed in town at the Wetlands. That's the club I was
okay.
at. So Ben and Stacey came and see me at the Wetlands.
Okay.
It was a big show, and they were convinced to like put the song in the movie.
Crazy.
And then Ron Fair, the A&R man who was at EMI Records, the boss of Rob Gordon, who was interested in me in college. He put my song on the soundtrack.
There you
at
go.
At RCA Records.
And my colleagues were asking me, and I couldn't answer, which is, someone at Billboard should know this, and in the charts department they definitely do, but how do you have a number one song that is not on your own album? Like, where are those numbers?
It's a single. It's a number one single.
So is it?
It's bad timing. I didn't have my own album out. It's
so
too
it's
bad.
Like radio play,
radio
and
play and
people
sales.
Actually buying the single yes. in the record store.
Yes. Exactly.
So it says like Reality Bites.
It says Lisa Loeb Stay from the yeah.
Got it. Okay.
I know it was amazing, but it was also unfortunate that we didn't have the entire record recorded yet.
Yeah.
I had a lot of songs that probably could have been released as the record.
Right.
But we thought we needed to record the record.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Afterwards, so the record came out like a year later.
Uh huh.
But so the song
was
number one.
At Sorry. That point?
No, Sorry. I was unsigned. No. When Stay came out and when it went to number one, I signed to Geffen Records when it was at number one that summer.
Okay.
But I have to say, even though it was independent, RCA Records, once the song started getting played on the radio,
uh-huh.
RCA Records radio department, they pushed the record. You know, they promoted the record.
Right.
As my parents would say, they pushed the record. You know, they pushed it. But they did. They really got into promoting it. And I'm still really good friends with Skip Bishop, who is the head of promotion there for Top 40 mm-hmm. Music. And I think it also helped that Ethan made a video for the song.
Right. Yes. How soon did that happen?
In, I don't remember. Simultaneous, I feel like it was like a few months after. We had the rights. We had to convince RCA to let us make a video because uh-huh. there were other songs on the roster to be singles from the record. Mm-hmm. And I remember meeting at Potbelly Stove, which was this great small restaurant on Christopher Street, with Ron Fair, the executive, and our video executive, and Ethan. And Ethan had told me what he wanted the video to be. In his apartment, he showed me the choreography, mapping out how it would be one take.
Right.
And I'd be moving over here and then telling the story and looking at the camera and the whole thing. And he explained it to the record company, and they said yes. I always think they said yes because it was Ethan, and he's like a famous actor. But really, the great thing was the concept. It was so unusual at the time, and it really stood out. And I think—
People love a one take.
One take is really so hard, impressive. Yeah.
It was really one take, yeah.
Amazing.
Before we move on to what happens next, because I'm curious what—
But just, we can't stay here all night, unfortunately, just to remind you, Dara.
Okay, well, okay, but I would
and
love to ask this question.
I think they actually, cut the air off in this library.
Oh, no.
People are getting sweaty.
Okay, well, I just really want to ask this question.
Yes.
The moment of creating that riff, or the lyric and the riff that is so instantly recognizable and so loved, like so beloved, you just start playing those first notes to Stay.
Right.
Do you remember that moment? Can you take yourself back and like relive chills? Like, does that give you a feeling, something that gives us a feeling? Every time we hear it, you just hear that. I'm not going to try to sing it,
yeah,
but just those notes.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It's really weird. What gives me the if there is a feeling for that song, it's the actual ding, you know, like the little two chords. I'm singing like the bass line in an octave up, but it's the, and I thought what I felt was simple, just the chords, the groove of the chords. It just felt kind of like modern or something at the time. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember that. I do remember from my song Do You Sleep, when I was playing that lick and singing over it. I wrote that in college, actually. And I remember feeling like, whoa, this is... There are some things that I write that I'm like, whoa. But for Stay, there wasn't
It wasn't that moment.
It was more the lick. It was more the lick and the feeling of like, oh, I'm kind of singing this melodic thing over it. And I remember mm-hmm. sitting on a mattress in New York City. You know, we like putting our mattresses on the floor because it was fun to be close to the floor.
Room for a bed frame or a headboard in New
York.
No,
it was just comfortable. I like being really close to the floor.
I
really modern.
Without sheets, too.
There were sheets. Like, yeah.
That's gross. Just like a can
of
soda.
I'm like, I pounded the pavement, but I'm always like, we can get a hotel. You don't have to sleep on someone's floor. Everyone's like, I slept on a floor. I'm like, why? You know, if you call a hotel, you can get a really good rate.
Right.
And, you know, you can, I'm always like, sort of grown up and mature and trying to figure out like a grown up approach about those kind of logistics.
Are you romantic about the music industry from that time?
No, not at all. I'm not romantic about the music industry. I like that.
Well, you don't seem to have been stymied by the changes in the industry. You might feel
I'm
differently.
I'm stymied. Well, this is the deal. Early on, I had a lot of advice from a lot of people, and I loved learning about the music business. And I knew from early on, when you get a record deal, yes, it is like getting a job because you can tell your parents, oh, I've got a record deal.
Right.
And it feels like a next big step, but I knew it wasn't the end. And I knew that that wasn't all there was. And when they gave you money for a record, you put a lot of it away. You're very conservative. You don't buy some fancy car. That's the money that you're living on. You get health insurance. You know, I knew all these kind of things that are really boring, but create a very solid, consistent life. And you always try to figure out how to market yourself. Early on, I realized even when there might be a publicist at the record company, you really are, it behooves you to do a lot of the work yourself mm-hmm, as well mm-hmm. or speak up. You know, it was funny at Geffen Records, they'd always joke that in Dallas we had the best promotion because Edie Brickell's family was there and my family was there. and people would walk into the record stores and say, where's the posters? You know, I used to be disillusioned and say, why is my mom telling us the posters are not up? That's how it works.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, there's a huge street team and your record company, and there's moms and cousins and friends and fans. And it's very I learned early on it has to be very grassroots. What I am stymied by, and I think everybody is the whole digital music issue because we're still up against the same issues marketing your music. There's so much out there. Right. You still have to market your music. It's not like, oh, you could just put it out. Mm-hmm. You still have to guide people towards your music. A lot of people do their own social media. I do mm-hmm. a lot of my social media, but I also delegate it as well to people because I have a whole other life. I am not on my Twitter right. every second. I am right. more when I'm on the road without my kids yeah. and stuff. But I there's a separation between personal and public and a sort of a crossover where you it's a gray area. Mm-hmm. And you still have to do a lot of marketing, which still costs money, but there's no budgets.
Right.
You still have to do a lot of promo, and there's no and there's so many outlets that you try to choose the best ones, like talking with you guys. This is really cool. And like you have other I'm in great company with all the other artists you've been on, and the experience itself is a good one. So that's quality. And people listen to it. No, but you know, you like there are yeah. there are other things that make success other than just sales.
Right.
That being said, you know, two out of the four ways musicians make money. Boop, gone.
Yeah.
Don't sell records anymore. Don't really get airplay.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to make the best of that is it's not what we all planned. It's like, you know, having a retirement fund that like, oh, it went away.
Oh yeah.
Oh right. well. You know, so it's very strange. You know, luckily for me I have a lot of different things I'm interested in. So that I have different sort of elements of my business and what I mm-hmm. enjoy doing.
Yeah. And this situation with Amazon seems smart.
I've been working with Amazon a lot, putting out records exclusively. Yeah. You know, it's hard because people say, but it's not on iTunes. I'm like, yeah, but it's on Amazon.
Right.
And I'm like, I go to Amazon multiple times a day to buy
right.
things
yeah.
as a mom, as a human. And the more people know that music is available there, and if you're a Prime member, you can get it for free.
Yep.
And I still sell actual CDs at my shows, although who knows how long I'll be doing that for because yeah. – kids, right. I know, like to look at CDs, but it's, you know, there's
well,
different
it might
logistics.
Be vinyl now.
Well, we do vinyl as well, but vinyl's hard to travel with. It's heavy, yep. it warps.
Yep.
Yeah.
It sells well, though. That's good.
All right, let's talk about Cafe Carlyle.
Oh, yeah, Cafe
that's
Carlyle.
That's why we snag you here in
yes,
New York.
Our favorite place to go.
It is our, yeah.
On a date.
Our little date spot. So yeah. June 6th to the 17th.
Yes.
Is when you'll be there. Playing beautiful songs over people's steak and mashed potatoes.
I know.
Such a different
like
setting.
Really good steak and mashed potatoes. Yeah. I don't mean that in a demeaning way.
I actually wrote, you know, I do mailers to my fans and friends and fans. And I wrote about how I was doing Cafe Carlyle. And I wrote that, you know, and you can have things like filet mignon.
That's
and,
right.
You know, lobster bisque uh-huh. and flourless chocolate cake.
And
in fact, you will be forced
wine.
To yeah. eat. I said you will be forced to eat and drink.
Yeah.
If you go. But it is, it's
guaranteed good time.
It's funny when I was here playing in New York City starting out, you know, the Upper East Side was really far away, even though I did start out living on the Upper East Side. But to play up there for grown-ups,
yeah.
you know, it was like we're Broadway singers and cabaret singers. And,
yeah, it's not for lazy know, Gen X singer-songwriters.
Yeah, no,
yeah exactly. And so, and I always loved the idea and the actuality of playing at CBGB's or the Wetlands and playing with my band. And,
yeah.
and little by little through the years, part of it logistics because it's easy for me. And part of it, artistically, I've enjoyed it. I've honed it down. So I'm mostly just playing me with a guitar lately.
Uh-huh.
I do sometimes, like when a new record comes out, I'll bring another guitar player who sings so that we can have more variety. And I love guitar solos and harmonies. Or if I go to Japan, I'll play with a band. You know, there's certain situations I'll play with a band. But in general, it just, I play with a guitar, and that way all the sets I play can be different, and I tell stories. And
mm-hmm.
more and more, I just really enjoy an intimate crowd or a quiet crowd that's set up for listening, you know, rows of seats, theaters, dinner theaters. So this is kind of the culmination of that. It's
yeah.
like back in New York City at a place where grown-ups listen. And I am a grown-up.
There you go.
I can't believe
it.
Like,
you made
I'm
it.
A grown-up. And, you know, I still feel a little bit like a little kid at the grown-ups dinner party when I'm there.
It's probably harder when you have kids
yeah,
to
exactly,
feel that way.
Yeah. Well, if they're not around, I feel more like a kid. When they're around,
yeah.
I am a grown-up.
Right?
but it's sort of a really, it actually is a really great, I feel like it's going to be a really good place to play. And for the audience to be able to listen.
So
and
lovely.
I like playing requests from the audience. I always put a big section
You're gonna
of...
You can take requests?
Yeah, I usually put a nice chunk in there for requests because, again, like I think of myself, I was such a huge music fan growing up. I went to so many concerts. I would stand in line for people's autographs. I would read, you know, books about David Bowie and, you know, we didn't have the internet, so just finding a magazine clip about the police
yeah.
or whatever was such a big deal, you know, learning about someone's life and to hear songs that they wouldn't typically play in concert.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. And so to actually hear a fan say, oh, will you play this song, you know, yeah. this deep track.
Yeah, yeah.
I will try yeah. my best. I'm still learning some of my own songs because I have so many songs
that.
To choose
I
from.
Love
I have
that.
To learn
it's
it.
So fun.
It's kind of
okay, well, Dara and I are going to work on our requests and yes. we'll send them yes. to you ahead of time so you can make sure you have them down. Mm-hmm. We'll
and there'll be Twitter and all that stuff. But yeah, I'm excited to play there. I am cool. looking forward to seeing a lot of people. And what I also enjoy, and I've noticed a lot from concerts, is usually half the people are there to see me and half of them are brought by the person who's there to see me.
Yeah.
But usually after the show when I'm signing autographs, which I normally do, we'll see if I'll do that at the Carlisle, the other half said, oh, you know, that was – I get sort of the best of both worlds. I get the feeling I got when I started out in New York and you mm-hmm. could see the discovery and you could feel yeah. that in the audience.
A pleasant surprise.
But then, yeah, but then also the sort of already people who are fans.
Yeah, you satisfied
listening. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's a great balance of both.
Awesome. Very nice. Exciting. And then I have to ask you about the other thing that you had to talk about today or that was suggested we could talk about, which is Lisa Loeb eyewear.
Oh, yes.
Which is amazing. I did not know that it existed.
Yes.
And when I heard it, I was like,
so
hell
natural,
yes, of course.
Seems, yeah. yeah, exactly. Of
like,
course.
Like so smart yeah. for her to do well, that.
It's a good topic for a music podcast because when I first started out in New York and started doing interviews, even in college, people knew me for my glasses, yeah. even in high school. But when I became, you know, on the charts and the public eye and all that, I would sit down for a really serious interview. You know, I thought, and they'd say, so tell me about your glasses. And I was so offended. I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah.
You're talking to me about my glasses? And I was already a little on edge because when I made the Stay video, I wasn't playing guitar and my band wasn't in the video. And that was a really big deal for me. Mm-hmm. We actually shot the video Stay with me and my guitar and my band just in case. We didn't use it because the better artistic vision was the one take video and me singing. But I felt like I'm actually a musician. Like, I've been playing guitar. I've been writing since I was 6 years old. I've been playing guitar since I was, you know, 13 and writing songs my whole life and performing. Why are we talking about my glasses? And it took me years to realize one of the things I love about Elton John, David Bowie, some of my huge heroes, it's their style.
Yeah.
It's the Police's blonde hair. I'm really excited about that. Yep. It doesn't demean their music. It doesn't make me feel upset about it. I like, you know, I think Elvis Costello wore creepers at some point. They're really cool.
yeah.
But I listen to their music.
Uh-huh.
So finally I realized I could do both.
You can embrace it.
And my glasses, it's a huge hobby of mine as well. Yeah. and I love going into stores and looking for glasses. So when I had an opportunity to start my own eyewear line, I jumped on it and I said, yeah, I really want to do this. You know, this would be a great thing. I could help design glasses, work with professionals, learn more about the business.
Yeah.
And people could have glasses like mine when they come up to me all the time and say, I'm wearing your glasses.
Yeah.
And I could say, well, let me help you find some that are even cuter. Because I love finding the right glasses that help people express their personality and what they want to present to the world. You know, like, I'm shy, don't look at me. Or I'm confident,
right.
I'm in charge. Or,
right.
You can come talk to me, and I'm kind of sexy too.
Yeah, I know, think like, all that shape just says, "Come talk to me." I'm confident. Yeah,
and they're not all cat eyes, like, but right. they're. But it's really been a great project, you know. And I get to connect with so many people and eye doctors and people who put glasses in there. We mostly sell them at ophthalmologists and opticians' office boutiques.
Mm-hmm.
We also sell a select number of styles and colors at Costco, and also have some for young women as well, like young girls.
Amazing.
It's wonderful.
This is
You're
exciting.
Smart. Yeah. You're smart lady. That's awesome. And I just got a new prescription, so I'm actually going to do a little shopping, I think.
That could be cute. Yeah, we do fittings sometimes, too.
Really?
I could help you figure out which ones looks cutest.
That would be awesome.
Who else would I ask? But Lisa Loeb for Lisa Loeb Eyewear.
Yes, I will tell you.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, I think
if we must.
I feel good. Yes, if we must part.
Okay.
Thank you, Lisa.
This was
thank
awesome.
You very much. Thank you.
You say I only hear what I want to. And you say I talk so all the time. So, and I thought what I felt was simple, and I thought that I don't belong, and now that I am leaving, now I know that I did something wrong, cause I missed you. Yeah, I missed you. And you say I only hear what I want to, I don't listen hard. where I don't understand. If you really care, I'm only hearing negative. No, no, no bad. So I turn the radio on, I turn the radio up, and this woman was singing my song. Lover's in love and the others run away. Lover is crying cause the other won't stay. So my was having a real weep for the other who was dying since the day they were born. Well, well, this is not that thing that I'm throwing, but I'm thrown. And I thought I'd live forever, but now I'm not so sure. You try to tell me that I'm clever, but that won't take me anyhow or anywhere with you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.